So our passage this morning is Matthew's Gospel, chapter 6, verses 19 to 24. And if you were here then last week, you may remember that in the immediately preceding verses, Jesus talks about fasting. And he assumes then that his disciples will fast, which prompted us last week to ask the question, why? Why would we New Testament Christians fast? And you may remember then we picked up on a couple of clues within the context, and we suggested two reasons why we New Testament Christians might fast. First, we might fast because some situation has arisen which calls for extraordinary prayer. So you're praying through a particularly big decision that you have to make. Or you're praying for preservation in the face of a particularly intense temptation. And there you are doing that. And lunchtime comes. And your tummy's beginning to rumble. And at that point then you would normally drop everything and go and grab a sandwich or something. But on this occasion you don't. You say to yourself, no, it's more important that I pray. In other words, you fast. And so that's one reason then why you might fast, because of a situation of extraordinary prayer. But then secondly, we said that we might fast as a kind of mechanism that stops us becoming dependent on things we shouldn't be dependent upon. I think last Sunday morning I singled out coffee and chocolate. And I said then that these, of course, are things that as Christians we are free to enjoy and to enjoy with thankfulness to God. Everything God created is good and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving, 1 Timothy 4, verse 4. But if we get to a point where our happiness depends on a certain number of cups of coffee or a certain amount of chocolate being taken in during the day, and we're saying, well, without that coffee, without that chocolate, my life just wouldn't be worth living, then that's a problem, isn't it? Jesus will say in verse 25, is not life more than food? And of course Paul will say in Philippians 1:21, for me to live is chocolate. No, for me to live is Christ, he will say. And if then we're getting near to that point where that's becoming obscured and confused in our lives, and we're becoming dependent on something tiny, something created, something like that, even if we're getting just slightly near to arriving at that point, then a period of abstinence from that coffee or from that chocolate might be appropriate. That is to say, a fast. Perhaps not, in this case, a blanket fast. Perhaps a product-specific fast. Cutting out of our lives for a while those things that are in danger of becoming too important to us. And you may remember then that in connection with that second type of fasting, I extended the application beyond just food. I said it might be technological devices that are becoming too important to us, and so we need to temporarily abstain from them. It might be possessions that are becoming too important for us, and so we need to perhaps have a clear out of some of our stuff. And you may have thought when I was saying that last Sunday morning then that extending the fast principle to those kinds of things, it was a little bit far-fetched. That connection between food being too important to us and possessions being too important to us is a little bit tenuous. But actually, I think it's precisely that connection that explains why these verses we're looking at this morning suddenly appear. Having talked about fasting, Jesus now in verses 19 to 24 talks about possessions. Why? Well, because possessions, like food, can become too important to us. They can become things that we depend upon. And as then Jesus, in these verses, prompted, as I say, by the discourse he's just given on fasting, as Jesus now turns his attention to possessions, he does essentially three things. Notice with me, first of all, then, he makes a rational appeal. He makes a rational appeal. And this is verses 19 to 21. And the appeal then, which Jesus makes in these verses, is a two-sided appeal. It begins, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth." So that's one side of this appeal. Perhaps we might say the negative side of this appeal. It involves a do not. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. And I guess then these are words about which we can easily get ourselves tied up in knots. And we come then to this phrase, and we ask the question then, well, at what point does my savings account become treasure? I mean, we know it's not wrong to possess money. We know it's not wrong to prudently have some money set aside. So at what point then does my savings account become treasure? At what point do I cross a line and I'm no longer just kind of prudently saving for future eventualities and I'm now laying up for myself treasures on earth? And we come to this end and we're looking for a kind of nice, clear-cut figure. That, you know, once we hit this amount, then we've crossed the line. Once we hit this figure in our savings account, then we've crossed the line and the treasure word comes into effect. And as long as we're the right side of that line, as long as we're the right side of that amount, then we're not in Matthew 5:19 territory. We instinctively want kind of things to be clear cut like that, don't we? And if only Jesus would give us a figure here, if only he would give us a definite amount, then it would all be so much more satisfactory. But I think that's a wrong approach here. I mean, for one thing, it falls foul of common sense, doesn't it? It falls foul of common sense. Because we all know, don't we, that treasure is a much more subjective category than that. So you're visiting a friend's house, and there sitting on his shelf in the living room is a football signed by the Newcastle United players. And so you say to your friend, "Let's go and have a kickabout in the back garden." And of course your friend looks at you aghast. He's mortally offended by this suggestion. He intends to keep that ball to show his grandchildren in years to come. And so you see the point then, that to you, it's a football for playing with, whereas for him, it's a treasure to be carefully preserved. And so I'm saying mere common sense tells us then that you can't really define in objective terms when something becomes treasure. So it falls foul of common sense, but then for another thing, it falls foul of the text itself here. We have an inflatable kayak that we take with us on holiday, and as with any inflatable product, then you want to know if you've inflated it to the right level. And so our present inflatable kayak, it has a proper pressure gauge with it, but the last one didn't. It came with this little strip of paper, and so the little strip of paper had two marks on it, and on the inside of the kayak there were two marks, and so you put the strip of paper onto there, and if the marks aligned, then you knew that you had inflated it to the right level. Well, these verses actually come with a strip of paper like that. A simple test to determine whether we are in fact laying up treasures on earth. And it isn't a figure. As we said, that wouldn't work. That once you hit this amount in your savings account, it's treasure. No. Look at verse 21. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. That's the issue. If something has captivated your heart, to put it bluntly, if you're in love with it, that's your treasure. And that's so helpful, isn't it? You see, one person might have £1 million in his bank accounts. And he plans to use it with discernment and with generosity. And he gets on with his daily life. The £1 million, in a sense, is no bigger deal to him than the £10 note that's lying in your wallet right now. But then there's another person who has £1 million in the bank. And for him, then, the possession of that money fills his dreams and his daydreams. He can't stop thinking about it and all that he intends to buy with it. And he checks his bank account every day to make sure it's still there. That's his treasure. And so the first side, then, of Jesus' appeal here, the negative side, it's an appeal against that. When Jesus says, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, he's not interested in defining amounts and quantities. He's interested in where the heart is. He's saying, don't let your heart be captivated by a salary, or by an inheritance, or by a house, or by a car, or by a toy, or by an item of jewelry, or by an heirloom, or by a painting, or by an antiquarian book, or by a motorbike, or by a jet ski, or by anything of that kind. That's what Jesus is saying. Don't let your heart get captivated. What about the other side of Jesus' appeal then? Well, the other side is this, verse 20, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. And here too, I think there's often been a wrong approach. And there's been an emphasis then on the lay up part of that phrase. Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. And there's been this idea then sometimes, and you find this in some of the commentators, that we lay up treasures in heaven by the way in which we use our present earthly possessions. So we kind of invest our money in causes that have an eternal significance. And by doing that then, by using our money in things that have an eternal significance, we are laying up for ourselves treasures in heaven. Now, doubtless, investing our money in things that have an eternal significance is a good thing. But I don't think that's what this text here is about. For one thing, there's nothing in the context to suggest that that's what this means. Indeed, the most basic understanding of the gospel is enough to tell us, is it not? That Jesus has won for us treasures in heaven through his finished work, through his death and resurrection. And we therefore lay up treasures in heaven, not by using our money in a certain way, but by clinging helplessly to Jesus and to the finished work of Jesus Christ. Are you doing that this morning? Are you clinging helplessly to Jesus Christ? Because in doing that, you are laying up treasure in heaven. Jesus has won treasure through going in our place to the hell of Golgotha, to the terrors of Calvary. And if you are clinging to him this morning, you are, by definition, laying up treasures in heaven. But I think, actually, the real emphasis in verse 20 isn't anyway on the action of laying up. It's on the attitude involved. We said in relation to verse 19 that you can be laying up savings in a savings account. That's not the issue. The issue is your attitude to them. Making sure that they are not your treasure, that they are not captivating your heart. And similarly then, here in verse 20, Jesus is interested in the attitude that we have to our future heavenly possessions as believers. Are we making sure that they are our treasure and that our hearts are captivated by our future heavenly possessions? So verses 19 to 21 then, they're saying to us, don't be preoccupied with earthly possessions, but rather be preoccupied with heavenly possessions. And one more thing then, just before we move on to our second heading. My first heading, you remember, was Jesus makes a rational appeal. Jesus makes a rational appeal. Why should we be preoccupied with heavenly possessions, not earthly possessions? Well, he gives us, doesn't he, an eminently sensible, straightforward, logical reason why. And it's this: don't lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. And it's perfectly plain, isn't it, what he's saying? The house, the car, the jewelry, all those other things I mentioned that can captivate our hearts, they're perishable things. They will die at the hands of moths or rust or thieves. And if they don't die, we will die. And the relationship with them will be severed in that way. There is an hour when I must part with all I hold most dear. And life with its best hopes will then, as nothingness, appear. The possessions of the world to come, on the other hand, they are imperishable. Our bodies in that world to come will be imperishable. Paul uses that language of them in 1 Corinthians 15, 42-44. There'll be no decline in our resurrection bodies, no wearing down, no depletion of energy and capability, no aging process. You more creative believers out there, in the world to come, you will design things and make things, and they will last. And they won't need to be repaired or replaced. They won't start to look tired or run down at any point. You more scientifically minded believers, in the world to come, you'll be able to apply your science positively rather than negatively. Not looking for ways to slow down cancer and Alzheimer's, and ways to combat climate change, but rather harnessing the wonderful potential of God's new universe in a whole range of positive ways. What a prospect, inhabiting an imperishable world. And so if you're a believer this morning, don't cling jealously to the silly little possessions of your present existence, which are on their way out. Remember how the writer to the Hebrews addresses his readers in that passage that we read there in the end of Hebrews 10, and he recalls, doesn't he, what those believers were like when they first became Christians. And he says in verse 34, you had compassion on those in prison, and you, this astonishing words, you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property. Why? Were they crazy or something? No, there was a reason why. Because you knew that you yourselves had a better possession, and an abiding one. Be like them. Be like them. Don't cling to silly little trinkets that are dying and expiring and on their way out, but rather look forward to the better and abiding possessions of a world that is still to come. So that's the first thing, and that was what I wanted to spend longest on this morning. In this passage, Jesus, first of all, makes a rational appeal. But then secondly, he issues a strong warning. He issues a strong warning, and this is verses 22 and 23. And this is where he talks then about the eye being the lamp of the body and the whole body being full of light and all the rest of it. And perhaps you find this paragraph a little bit confusing then. What does this language here mean? Well, Jesus is saying then, at a basic anatomical level, at the basic physical level, he's saying that the health of your eyes has a very far-reaching significance. So you might have a bad foot, or a bad leg or a bad wrist or something, and it's a little bit disabling, but you still manage to get by and to do a fair number of things with that dodgy leg or wrist or whatever. When your eyes aren't working, though, it's a different matter altogether, isn't it? Jesus says that plunges the whole body into darkness. So imagine then that you're playing rugby and your eyes aren't working. And your hands then, they don't have some independent means of vision so that you can still receive the ball safely from your teammates. No, your hands grope helplessly. They are in the dark. And if by chance you do receive the ball from one of your teammates, your legs don't have some independent means of vision so that they can just head purposely for the try line. No, your legs move about cluelessly. They are in the dark. And so, in other words, you can't, in that situation, you can't say, well, it's okay, it's just my eyes that are in darkness. You know, it's just those little organs there in my face. But for the rest of my body, it's business as usual. It doesn't work like that, does it? No, the darkness is total when your eyes are bad. That's what the language means. So what's Jesus' point? Why is he saying this? Well, the point is this. The Bible often uses eyes to refer to a person's fundamental preoccupation. So Psalm 119, verse 15. I will meditate on your precepts and fix my eyes on your ways. Now the psalmist doesn't mean that literally. He's not talking about his physical eyes. He's not talking about literally staring fixedly at God's law. No, he means that I am preoccupied with your ways. That's what he means. Or I think of a couple of New Testament texts that relate even more closely to the context here in Matthew 6, 2 Corinthians 4. And I mentioned this last Sunday evening in connection with Samson. 2 Corinthians 4:18, where Paul says, so we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. And clearly he's not talking literally, because it's impossible to fix your eyes on something that's invisible. So he's saying that I'm preoccupied, or we believers, he's saying, are preoccupied with that unseen future God has lined up for us. Or Ephesians 1 that we sang earlier on, Ephesians 1:18, I pray also that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened, so in order that you may know the hope to which he has called you. And Paul is saying that I'm praying that these non-physical eyes, the eyes of your heart, may be preoccupied with the hope that is lined up for you. And Jesus is saying then, just as a problem with your physical eyes has far-reaching significance, so a problem with your eyes in this sense, your fundamental preoccupation, that is, if your fundamental preoccupation is present earthly possessions rather than future heavenly possessions, that too has far-reaching significance. Just as dysfunctional eyes, these ones, plunge the whole of you into darkness, so a fundamental preoccupation with present earthly possessions rather than future heavenly possessions plunges the whole of you into darkness in a far profounder sense. And let's note that term darkness, because of course, if you've read the Bible, if you've read much of the Bible, you'll know that darkness is one of the Bible's bleakest metaphors. Darkness in the Bible stands for evil, for judgment, for the opposite of everything that God is. God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all, 1 John 1 verse 5. Which means, I think, that Jesus is actually saying this. He's saying, and remember he's talking to his disciples here, all these yous and yours. He's addressing not the Pharisees, not the scribes now. He's addressing his disciples. He's saying, you might be a professing Christian. You might be a member of an evangelical church. But if your fundamental preoccupation is wrong, if you're more concerned with the here and now than with the there and then, if you're more concerned with getting to the top of the career ladder than with the return of the Lord Jesus Christ, if you're more concerned with having the best things of this life than with taking possession of your eternal inheritance, that raises serious question marks about whether you actually are Christ at all. The I cannot be bad and the rest of you be fine. It raises the possibility that you, in fact, are living in darkness and not in the light of life. And that's why my heading then, the second heading, was Jesus issues a strong warning. It's a very strong warning, I think, in this paragraph. And this is not some rogue text in the New Testament. Again, we read, didn't we, the first verses of Hebrews chapter 11. And I think I've talked about this before. Of course, I preached through Hebrews 11. And whoever it was that wrote this, he writes in verse 6, without faith it is impossible to please him. That's God. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. So we take the first bit of that. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. And we say, well, yes, of course, without saving faith, without that helpless dependence on the finished work of Jesus Christ, it's impossible to please God. That's fine. We're okay with that. But remember, in Hebrews 11, the writer is not talking about faith in the sense of that saving faith, that justifying faith, that helpless dependence on the finished work of Jesus Christ. In Hebrews 11, throughout most of Hebrews, in fact, faith is that looking forward to the world to come. That's what faith is. That's why he goes on in the second half of the verse, that you must believe that God exists and that he rewards, not rewards now, but rewards in the future, rewards at the return of Christ, those who seek him. So the writer is saying something pretty stark. He's not just saying that without saving faith, it's impossible to please God. That's pretty obvious. He's saying without a future orientation to your whole life, it's impossible to please God. Without your life being focused on what is to come at the return of Jesus, it's impossible to please God. In other words, this is not an add-on. This is not like a spiritual gift. We talk about the spiritual gifts that Paul lists in 1 Corinthians 12 and 14 and one or two other places, and we say, well, you know, the Holy Spirit gives one gift to this believer, another gift to that believer, and that's fine. I don't have to have the same gift as my brother or sister in Christ. It's not like that with looking forward to the world to come. Well, that's how that believer lives, and that's kind of the way God has shaped that Christian, but that's just not the way that God has shaped me. No, this is non-negotiable. This is basic. This is essential. Remember how Paul says, doesn't he, in Romans 8? He says that we have the, not only so, but we who have the first fruits of the Spirit grown inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. So he's talking about the future. We groan inwardly as we wait for the redemption of our bodies. And then he adds this, for in this hope we were saved. We were saved when we heard about Jesus dying for us, and then 10 years down the line, we heard, oh, there's also a future inheritance, and that's good too. No, the hope of everlasting life was part of our original conversion. It was what we were being converted to, not just a purpose-driven life for a few years here on earth, but an eternal inheritance. This is essential, it's integral to the gospel. And so what Jesus is saying here is perfectly consistent with other parts of the New Testament, that a healthy eye That is a healthy preoccupation with the future is absolutely vital for any disciple of his. We need to examine ourselves this morning. We live in a world that is constantly trying to suck us into a here and now orientation. Constantly, through all its media, it's trying to do that. And we live in a world as well where now we have so many comforts, don't we, and luxuries, here in the West at least. Far more than our Christian forebears whose writings we read. And so we can easily start to think, well, we're comfortable here, we're at home here. This is fine, I'm happy now. And we must never let ourselves, but rather we must be those who constantly are exercising Hebrews 11 faith. Faith in the city that is to come. So he makes a rational appeal. He issues a strong warning. But then thirdly and finally, he closes a tempting loophole. He closes a tempting loophole. And this is verse 24. And the loophole to which I refer then goes something like this. Well, yes, I recognize that I am perhaps rather focused on present earthly possessions and that they are rather a big deal for me, but that's okay because I can have two preoccupations going on in my life. You know, it's like when you're driving and you're kind of looking at different things at the same time, aren't you? I mean, legitimately so. You're looking at your speedometer to check that you're not breaking the speed limit. But you're also looking at your mirrors to see what's going on behind you. And you're also glancing at your sat-nav to check that you're taking the right lane at this junction that's coming up. You're looking in different directions at the same time, and that works okay in the car. And so perhaps it works okay then in our approach to life, that we can have more than one kind of fundamental preoccupation. We can be driven by the future and by all that we're going to get then, but we can also be driven by making the most out of this life and becoming rich and having what our neighbour has. Well, Jesus closes that loophole, doesn't he? And he closes it rather emphatically. And he moves in verse 24 then from anatomical imagery to domestic imagery. The world of slavery. And remember then that a slave in that first century context was not a paid employee with a contract with terms and conditions nicely set out on it. No, a slave was 24/7 completely at the disposal of his owner. And so it might not seem ridiculous to us, but Jesus is painting a picture that would have immediately seemed ridiculous to his first hearers. The idea then of a man and he's slave in this house here, but he's also at the same time slave in another house down the road. And so he's 24/7 at their disposal and he's 24/7 at their disposal as well. And of course that just can't possibly work. And so it's a self-evidently ludicrous image that Jesus is painting within that cultural context. And he's saying then that it's just as impossible and it's just as ludicrous to be living both for the future, for heavenly possessions, and for the present, for earthly possessions. So that's his basic point in this paragraph. But just notice, as we close, two nuances. So one nuance is that he actually shifts now, doesn't he, from talking about heavenly possessions or treasures in heaven to talking about God himself. So he doesn't say here then that you cannot serve heavenly possessions and earthly possessions. He keeps the earthly possessions in view, but he says you cannot serve God and earthly possessions, or mammon. And I think it's helpful to notice that, because that reminds us, doesn't it, that we must never detach our future heavenly possessions from God himself. Yes, it's right to long for and pine for our heavenly eternal possessions, all the wonders of that world to come, but always only in close association with God himself. And it's perfectly expressed, isn't it, there in Psalm 16, with which we began our service this morning. Pleasures at your right hand. The psalmist is looking forward to pleasures, all right. The pleasures of that world to come. But not in some vacuum, not in some abstract sense, pleasures at your right hand. And we must make sure then that we haven't a view of paradise that is almost indistinguishable from the Muslim's view of paradise, where it's all very sensual and very physical. Yes, we are looking forward to a physical world to come, and that will be full of pleasures. But most of all, we're looking forward to seeing God and to communing with the triune God in a way that is beyond our capacities at this present time. And then the other nuance is that Jesus here uses such strong language, doesn't he? That he excludes even a kind of ranking of preoccupations. Okay, you know, God and heavenly future possessions, that's my really, really fundamental preoccupation. But, you know, a bit beneath that, I have this other preoccupation with now and with money and possessions and doing well. No, Jesus won't even allow for that, will he? That very stark language of hating the one and loving the other. He uses similar language elsewhere, doesn't he? Perhaps even more probingly in Luke chapter 24, verse 26. Luke chapter 14, verse 26. He says, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." Jesus is teaching us to hate our family. Now, of course, we can't take that out of context and absolutize that, because we have plenty of other teaching in Scripture on loving our spouses, loving our parents, and so on. But Jesus is saying there in Luke 14 that our love for everything else, including our love for family members, should be so distinguishable from the love that we have for God that it's almost a form of hatred by comparison. And he's saying the same thing here in relation to money. These shouldn't be kind of barely distinguishable loves with just a kind of a fraction of difference between them. No. Our attitude toward possessions, this world's possessions, should be so altogether different from our attitude toward God that it's as if we actually hate this world's possessions. So it's a challenging passage. It begins with this quite gentle appeal, this appeal to our reason almost. Look, why would you treasure what is so fleeting, what is so ephemeral? Treasure that which is going to last forever. But then soon moves on and changes tone, this passage, into this very strong warning. Look, your eye needs to be healthy. If your eye's not healthy, your preoccupation, you're in a serious situation. And then Jesus goes even further and closes off this loophole to us. And so let's ask ourselves this morning, are we preoccupied with heavenly possessions and most of all with God himself, the one in whose presence we shall spend eternity? In a world that wants to conform us to its image, are we resisting that? Are we countercultural? It's not about what we have or don't have, it's about our attitudes, our hearts. What are we treasuring? What are you treasuring? Let's ask ourselves such questions this morning. Amen.